Well, good evening and good morning, EPL State of Mind listeners. This week, the drama on and off the pitch reached new heights with yet another refereeing controversy that left fans scratching their heads and one particular club's Twitter admin losing their absolute mind. Plus, there's been another escape from the relegation battle and no shortage of drama in the FA Cup semifinals, courtesy of Manchester United. Without further ado, it's time to drive into the EPL State of Mind with myself and co-host Sean Larkin. Welcome back, Sean. How are we doing?
Good. You know, we are without the services of Karen Mansley. He's too busy snitching on somebody who rear-ended him today in Long Island. So he's got other more pressing responsibilities.
Yeah, I would say that's fair enough. It can't all be sunshine and rainbows for Kyle Karen Mansley this week and weekend. So just pile it on for him. But he will be missed. One thing that we would love talking to him about is obviously some international play, some red cards, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And we have some of this in the hot news segment for everyone today. And the first off, we're going to start with El Clasico, Real Madrid 3, Barcelona 2. This was in La Liga, pretty much seals the deal for me for Real Madrid into the title pole position without being able to or without having to look back. Now, that's huge because they are still, as we will talk about, in the Champions League competition. So this is a big stress reliever for Real Madrid. But to talk to us more about that, El Clasico himself, Sean Larkin.
Yeah. So obviously the biggest game in world football, really good back and forth matchup overall. I think Madrid were the better team and kind of deserved the points. First half, they definitely dominated. Barca seemed to get a little bit more control. They actually thought they went up 2-0. They scored once off an Andreas Christensen header early on, and then they looked like they scored another one with Lamine Yamal, who would have become the youngest scorer in El Clasico history, just to go along with being the youngest in everything otherwise, like in the history of sports, it seems like, because I'm pretty sure he was still in diapers when he made his debut for Barca. But it was not meant to be. He didn't cross over the line. And game was knotted up in extra time. I watched probably the last 40 minutes live. Saw Fermin Lopez and Lucas Vasquez's goals, and who else but to score the winner but Jude Bellingham, like he always seems to do, pops up at the back post off a cross from Vasquez that he finishes in stoppage time, his second stoppage time winner in an El Clasico game this season. And like you said, Madrid moves 11 points clear of Barca with just 6 games to go. It's basically, that's the title wrapped up. I mean, they probably were going to win it regardless, even if Barca were to win. But at this point, it's a wrap. Just Bellingham's first goal since February 10th. Obviously, he had that ankle injury that ruled him out for a while. But still, despite that, he's only one goal off the top spot for the Golden Boot race with 17 goals in La Liga this season. I can't remember the guy's name, but it's somebody at Girona who is 18. And then just the last note I had on this game was that there was reports that surfaced post-match that Barcelona's board, led by Deco, is hoping to convince Xavi Hernandez to stay as the manager. He made a decision publicly in February to leave, but since that time, Barca went on a 13-game unbeaten streak. They climbed from 5th place to 2nd in La Liga, and then obviously they reached the Champions League quarterfinals for the first time in 4 or 5 years, only to be knocked out by PSG, mostly due to a red card. They were in control of that tie before Ronald Araujo's red card, but will be very interesting. I think a big reason for that is just because there's just not that many top-class managers available, it seems like.
Yep, agreed. I mean, I think the biggest one on the market was going to be Alonso, right? Not Alonso. Why can't I? Yeah, Alonso. And now that he's claimed his spot still at the helm of the only continuously undefeated team in all competition, escaping with, I believe, what, a 97th winner over the weekend for Bayer Leverkusen again to make the undefeated streak go quicker. And I think Nagelsmann has re-signed with Germany as well. So he's locked into the international team's register as well. And then the pool's getting smaller and smaller. You know, Klopp is done. So they're going to have competition with Liverpool on potentially another big manager to come in to save their next season. So it's going to be very difficult manager's market. I'm still waiting for who's going to try to see if Potter can maybe come back into the swing of things, but I don't think he was ever fit for a larger club like Chelsea to begin with. So I don't think we would see him being entertained in the Liverpool and or Barcelona spot to begin with. And then I know Luis Enrique, who's the French,
Enrique, he's at PSG.
Yep. So all the big names that we were talking about at the beginning of the season have found homes. So, hey, if Xavi really thinks that he can stay and do something, I think it would be a good move for him. I think everyone kind of gives managers not enough time to really develop a squad, especially since Barcelona has been going through a lot of financial problems. Going back and forth with managers isn't going to help that either. So very interesting, especially the big factor. You said that they were on a 13 unbeaten streak since he said that he was done. So maybe a little middle finger there from him, but it'll be interesting.
For sure. And I think the other part of it that you just mentioned, obviously financially, he's not going to cost as much as if they went out and brought in a big time manager. The other guy who's been rumored, if Xavi does decide to step down, is Rafa Marquez, who's a former Barcelona player, but he is the current manager of Barcelona's B team. Obviously he was a Mexican legend. I think he played in the MLS too. I want to say for the Red Bulls at some time. I could be making that up. No, he did 2010 to 2012. So would be cool to have a little MLS flair in there. But definitely something to monitor, obviously not only him, but as you mentioned, the Liverpool job, and then a team we'll talk about right now, a team that's in the semifinals of the Champions League in Bayern Munich. Yep. Also be looking for a manager this summer.
Thomas Tuchel trying to save his potential career there, but he was another one that announced that he would no longer continue being the coach at his current club. They seem to come to a mutual agreement on that with Bayern Munich, although he has led them into a semifinals again. This makes the Bayern versus Real Madrid royalty collision. Combined, they have 20 Champions League trophies between the two clubs, which are more than any next combination of two. So this is going to be a battle of the big boys, really. And I still stand by what I said last week, that the winner of the Man City Real Madrid game would be in the driver's seat. So I do think that Real Madrid are now easily favorites for the competition. If they were not already favorites beforehand with Man City still in it, I would be saying the same thing if Man City won against Real Madrid during last week's matchup. So I think Real Madrid should win this relatively easily. Bayern Munich, they looked good. I think a lot of people are forgetting that, and we'll mention it relatively shortly in the next segment when we're talking about Borussia Dortmund and PSG. But the Champions League and the Euros this summer are going to be a big weighing factor in the Ballon d'Or. And Harry Kane has fucking lit up the Bundesliga for his first season, breaking, I'm pretty sure, all of Lewandowski's records in his first season in the Bundesliga, and really during his peak performances of his seasons in the Bundesliga. So Harry Kane might actually be in the running if Bayern Munich could pull out a Champions League victory here. That being said, obviously the defeat against Arsenal, or the defeating Arsenal last week, did not only create massive ulcers in my heart, mind, and body, but it was a good improvement, I think, for the Gunners to be back into the quarterfinals, first time in multiple years, and not getting slapped 10-2 in aggregate against Bayern Munich like last time. So improvement all around. Bayern Munich versus Real Madrid will be entertaining. I do see Real Madrid walking away with this one, though.
Agreed. I think they're a little bit too strong. There's still a couple of weaknesses, you know, within that Bayern team that they're still trying to figure out. They're kind of a team stuck in limbo between, you know, the old guard guys like Müller and Neuer, et cetera, and then also some of the young guys that are coming up as well. So I think Madrid has the advantage there, but certainly Bayern has the individual quality to, you know, to dominate a tie. And then going over to the other semifinal, we have Borussia Dortmund versus PSG. Another guy, like you said, who should be up as the favorite for the Ballon d'Or is Kylian Mbappe. And interesting stat on this one. So these teams actually were both in the group stage earlier this year. They're in Group F alongside AC Milan and Newcastle. First game was a 2-0 win for PSG in Paris, and then a 1-1 draw in Germany. This is the second time it's happened where two teams in the same group reached the Champions League semifinal. The other time was back in 1984-85 when Juventus beat my Liverpool Reds. But it is kind of interesting. Obviously not something that happens too frequently, because obviously if you're finishing second in the group, it's more likely that you're going to end up facing a really tough challenge in the round of 16.
Yeah, no, that's a crazy stat. To me, it's tough too because the game against Barcelona last week with PSG was a very close competition. I think Barcelona did a little hardship on that one. I think Barcelona looked good, especially in the recent form that they were in. To be honest with you, I just hope we don't see PSG win or go advance through this competition with controversial calls moving forward or really close competition. I think that will start to shed a poor light on the possibility that it's PSG's last Champions League with Mbappe. And I don't want to throw that out there as a conspiracy theory, but I think it will definitely be raised and a lot of heads will turn if there are some close, tight calls that would be going the Parisians' way. So we'll see. We'll see what we can do from there. As far as it goes for more international or different league football, a quick shout out for the Inter Milan Blues, the Zuri, they won their 20th Serie A title for the first time in a Milan derby where the title was determined in a Milan derby. So very intense game regularly. Throw the title competition in that and you got exactly what you expected. A 2-1 win for Inter Milan. There were three red cards in this game, two of which coming at the same time, I believe, in the 94th minute for both sides of a match. And that determined that Inter Milan will walk away with the trophy this season with five games remaining. So congratulations to the Zuri and our boy Luigi and my other boy Jeff Medrano, who I know both were possibly most likely in tears today, but of the happiness variety. So always happy to see, or better to feel it that way than the other way around. So congratulations, Inter Milan. Moving sweetly along here to the weekend wrap up as segment two, as we always do, we have another spin on the El Clasico and we have the El Relegacion, a little French, I think, on that one. L is Spanish, but the way I say Relegacion is more French, but Sean, Everton, Nottingham Forest, a lot to digest in this game on the pitch and off the pitch, like we noted in the intro.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's just focus on the pitch to start. Everton pretty much were caved in this game. Their two goals were both long shot bangers. The first one by Idrissa Gana Gueye in the, I think it was in the 26th minute, just his fifth Premier League career goal in 187 appearances. Beautiful strike by him, hits the post and goes into the net. And actually the same thing with Dwight McNeil. It was even further back, but once again, a shot from distance off the post and into the back of the net. So you always love to see that. But really the story of this game is Ashley Young and him. He should play the lottery because he is the luckiest man on the planet. He could have been penalized for three different penalty calls in this game and yet none were called. And that sent Nottingham Forest Club, who obviously are, you know, they've faced point deductions. They faced leaking butthurt all over the place when they lost to Liverpool at home a couple of weeks ago. And now, I mean, they really just completely lost their minds in this one. After the match, they tweeted out three extremely poor decisions, three penalties not given, which we simply cannot accept. We've warned PGMOL that the VAR official Stuart Atwell is a Luton fan, but he was not changed. Our patience has been tested multiple times. Nottingham Forest Football Club will now consider its options. And then today, basically their options are they're going to bitch and moan until the audio of the VAR dialogue between Anthony Taylor, the referee, and Stuart Atwell, the VAR, are released for each of the three penalty incidents. And just kind of quickly to walk you through each of the incidents. The first one occurred in the first half. Gio Reyna is in the box. He's looking to kind of whip a ball in. He's kind of on the corner of the left-hand side of the box. It's kind of very similar incident to the penalty that Calvin Phillips conceded mm-hmm. against Newcastle a couple of weeks back, where Reyna's first to the ball and Young kicks through him. No penalty there, and I can sort of understand why that wasn't called. I've certainly seen it given. Like I said, obviously the Phillips incident is very, very similar.
Yep.
But I also was critical of that decision and thought that it shouldn't have been given as a penalty. So I was fine with that one. The next one, it was again right towards the end of the first half. It's a cross in, I want to say, from Anthony Elanga. I might be wrong on that one, from the left-hand side. And it looks like a handball to me. They called it, they basically said due to proximity, it wasn't. But the third one, there's absolutely no excuse for. It's a nailed-on foul by Ashley Young on Callum Hudson-Odoi. He's in the box. It's like everything is clear as day. Basically, the official's explanation in the moment was that Ashley Young got the ball. But then after the VAR, you know, went through the replay, slowed it down, he didn't. So he didn't get the ball. If that's the only reason it wasn't given as a penalty, then you simply must. That's a clear and obvious error. Yep. He thought that there was contact made by Ashley Young on the ball. There was not. So then the contact that was made there, therefore, should be a foul. So listen, I mean, I've been, you know, trolling Nottingham Forest for a month now, but I totally understand. I would feel hard done by too.
Yeah.
I think they were, you know, a bit robbed in this game. Obviously there is some level of, you have to take your own chances as well. There's a couple of chances both by Morgan Gibbs-White on a break where he just completely missed the net. And then there was a Chris Wood chance from, I mean, point right blank. On top of the goalkeeper, point blank chance that, Pickford made a great save on, but you got to be doing better there. However, I mean, when you have three penalty shouts and none of them come off and you lose 2-0, it's really, really aggravating and really frustrating. So I totally understand, you know, where they're coming from there. And it just, again, goes back to things that we talked about consistently throughout this year and even dating back to last year on the pod. The officiating in this league is just not up to snuff and up to standard for what's, you know, the best league in the world.
Yeah, no, I agreed. And I think if they were to put the focus on the refereeing on this one, I mean, Sky Sports does a highlight show with ex-referee Dermot Gallagher that they go over the controversial points. And this one was, you know, a bit subpar of a review. I think you did a better review than Dermot Gallagher did on these three occasions. I completely agree with you. I think the first and the third incident are the larger shouts for the penalty kicks. I think the third one is by far the strongest case for Nottingham Forest. So putting that aside, they get a PK, they score that goal. It's 1-2 right at that point. I believe it was later on in the game. I can't remember what minute it was at, but this was a lot. This game to me, and I wasn't able to catch all of it, but you remember the middle school game knockout with basketball where you just, you're trying to get the person in front of you. This would be, to me, like the game where all of the really good shooters somehow got each other out, and the last two competitors in knockout was Everton and Nottingham Forest. This game was just a bunch of kids trying to beat each other at knockout who didn't know how to shoot a basketball. You had a total combined shots on target of 5 this game, and a total combined 8 total shots between the two teams. I mean, this is, like you said, El Relegacion. This is, you need to be on top of each other's boxes, shooting from whichever angle. I mean, to me, Nottingham Forest, you have had so much better games. You played better. But again, you have, I think, the second worst record in the league on away matches, only to be bested by, who do we have it here? You know, to Sheffield United. Sheffield. And they have the rest. They have the worst record in all of probably English Premier League history as of late. And then you have Fulham, who also is very poor from away from home. But Nottingham Forest, you can't be hanging your hat on one incident or multiple incidents in one game for it right now. I think the Chris Woods was more so great positional awareness from the defense on Everton to cut down the angle. And then Jordan Pickford just throwing his body like he's trying to jump on a grenade like he always tends to do. So listen, I'm also going to be a big Toffee fan for the rest of the season, just because I don't want them to have to be playing for anything on my last game of the season versus them in case we do go as far down. So to me, I think the game ended probably properly on the better side. And not to mention, I think without the point deduction, Everton would technically be above Nottingham Forest anyway. So it kind of levels out this way.
Yeah.
Doesn't make it easy for the rest of the relegation battle though, for all the teams I spoke about last week, especially with Luton. They really needed to win the game that they had this week. And we'll talk about it on the Rapid Kicks, but they got fucking swatted to shit by the Bees. So, you know, if you're Luton and you won on Saturday, you were hoping for Everton. Unfortunately, if you were a Luton fan and you're watching this game, you're hoping for a draw, but you still are in striking distance of Forest, who now sit in 17th with 26 points, and Everton in 16th with 30 points. So that's how we kind of wrap up the English Premier League for the weekend. You have anything else to add to this showing or this game or the you know, the results?
No, I would basically just say that Everton seem to be out of the relegation forest at this time.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, I just don't see Luton Town putting together more than, you know, two wins. And that basically just means that Everton just needs to pick up 1 point in their next five matches. And it would be hard to see them not, you know, I would be surprised if they didn't pick up some points. I mean, they have Luton Town away. They have Sheffield United at home. Yeah. They have Brentford at home. So those are games where they could, you know, easily pick up 3 points. They have a Merseyside derby against Liverpool on Wednesday, which obviously that game's always heated. You always know Goodison's going to be up for it. So I would say pretty safe to say that they'll be back in the Premier League once again, you know, despite flirting with relegation for the third year in a row. Mm-hmm. And then moving over from a team that's looking to get promoted is Coventry City taking on Manchester United in the FA Cup semifinal. This game, I've said this about games in the past, but this game truly was on crack.
It was on the rarest and rawest form of crack that you could probably get your hands on.
Straight, pure Colombian Bam Bam. That's what this game was on, because Manchester United hops out to a 3-0 lead within 59 minutes. They have goals from McTominay, from Maguire's big old slab head, and from Bruno Fernandes.
And on the actual physical broadcast, they said big head Maguire's big
yeah
head.
They said his
they said big yeah, head Maguire. I was like, come on, we gotta do him like that, man.
But everybody knows he's got a melon. It's not new. you're just stating the obvious. What are you gonna say next? Bruno Fernandes is ugly and Anthony's a piece of garbage. That one was more subjective.
Oh yeah.
And yet, despite all that, being down 3-0, Coventry City battles back, man. I really enjoyed watching this team go on an FA Cup run. It's unfortunate that they do fall short. But in this game, they scored 3 times in the final 20 minutes to send it into extra time, which included a stoppage time penalty from American Haji Wright. I think he's been really good. I was not a fan of his at the World Cup in 2022. I just didn't think he was the right guy at striker. But since Mark Robinson, manager at Coventry, has moved him over and used him more like a left wing, he's been really, really effective for them throughout this season, and was, again, the danger man throughout this game. So I just wanted to give him a special shout out. Like I said, he scored the equalizer. He also set up what looked like the winner in extra time, but then it got called back for offsides. And just like, damn it, VAR. You don't work how you're supposed to most of the time. And the one time you do work, it's to benefit United in what would have been the funniest banter on social media of the season by far. I can't think of anything that'd be better. But just unfortunate that United were able to pull it out on penalties. It looked like I said, that Victor Torp scored the game winner in stoppage time of extra time.
Yep.
But like I said, it was overturned by VAR. And just, again, my last gripe about VAR for today, if it takes 8 minutes to reach the conclusion that the guy's offsides, it's not a clear and obvious error. It's just not. That's very apparent that it was too close to call, basically, that if you had to look from 175 different angles and draw 37 lines from Aaron Wan-Bissaka's boot, it's probably not that big of a deal if the guy's, you know, fractionally offside or onside. And I would just rather that stands.
Just join, to me, it's just join the rest of the football world, especially in Europe, that they have automated offsides. So you take the guesswork out of it, you throw that up there, everyone sees it, it move on. That's it. It's relatively quick. It's painless. Some people might not agree with it, but to me, there's no float. There's no objectivity, like, oh no, I would draw the line here, I would draw the line. Just make it automated, and then you can maybe focus on all the bullshit that, you know, we witnessed in the Forest game, and you can focus on that, and you don't have to worry about offsides every time.
Absolutely. We've talked about it too, like, take as much out of the officials' hands as humanly possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think we will ever get to the VAR is going away, so you might as well try to just micromanage the stuff that you can micromanage and let the other stuff go, you know, delegate that shit to computers and robots. Erling Haaland, when he retires, will be reinvented into a small VAR box. Like, it's going to be very easy. But a crazy thing about that, if you, I don't know if you saw it on the broadcast, but they did show it. Because of how long that review process took, Manchester United fans had anticipated and assumed that they had lost the game and left the stadium. When they heard news that it, in fact, was ruled off, people were rushing back into the grounds to try to reclaim their spot on what would have or could have been one of the worst penalty kick shootouts in Manchester United history, losing. They ended up obviously winning, but starting off in the PKs, you had Casemiro, who I don't know what he decided to do. He must have watched Bernardo Silva over the week during his penalty kick shootout, because it was almost identical of just kind of floating it up in the middle towards the towards the Coventry keeper. It was unfortunate. Haji Wright, we did talk about earlier, he made his penalty kick, but Coventry would lose it in PK shootouts with their last man blasting it over the bar. That gave Rasmus Højlund the opportunity to seal the deal for the first time in Wembley for his Manchester United career. You'll notice that not a lot of people were chasing after him when he scored the goal, because this is just a tough one to, this is a tough one to celebrate. Unless you're Antony, then you decide to be a doucher and you walk up to the Coventry people's faces and taunts. I don't understand that, but you know, you had its big head slab. Maguire walked over and started shaking everyone's hand at Coventry, very respectfully so. I mean, they played a fucking second half.
Yeah. It's also funny to me that Antony was the one talking shit, because he came on in the 69th minute when it was 3-0. And then Coventry tied the game. So if you want to talk about what an impact he had on the game, he actually helped. He was almost like instantaneously Coventry got back in the game as soon as he came on. But
yeah.
I mean, just he's the perfect representation of the rot that is the institution of Manchester United right now, because he's overpaid. He's low class and low quality in terms of ability on the ball, or not even on the ball, just on the pitch. You're probably the wrong guy to ask this, and I'll probably post a poll because I feel like we have a good amount of Manchester United listeners, but do you think getting to an FA Cup final in this manner increases your belief that Ten Hag's the right guy for the job? Or do you think it's just kind of like, whatever, it's just a perfect case of how the whole season's gone? Like, they've gotten results, but it's never looked pretty or inspired confidence.
I think just because they have had no true form, I just don't think that you can back a manager in that sense. I don't think this helps Erik ten Hag's case. If they won 3-0, I sure as hell, sure, it does. Yeah, then he goes to a final that they haven't done in X amount of years, that only so many people have been able to accomplish multiple times at least. But he to me, he doesn't have a playing style. I always revert back to when Arteta joined Arsenal, similar situation, less funds, roughly the same amount of poor talent. You have maybe one or two good guys, younger guys. You can compare Garnacho to Saka. You put him on, you know, you put Garnacho on a pedestal. But at least Arteta came in with a game plan and set his team up in a way that, okay, I need to bring these key players in to possess the ball more, to work out from the back. And of course, you know, it helped that the Kroenkes had some patience and backed him. And I think that's something that the Glazers are trying to do with Erik ten Hag. But he just doesn't have a playing style. He also puts a lot of pressure on everyone to realize that he's been able to select his main squad one time the entire season. Yes, they have been able. They have been stricken with injuries. But you can't pin that on. If you have one or two guys missing, every team is going to have one or two guys missing an entire season. You should be able to plug someone in there to at least fill that void. So to make your question a long story short, I don't think this helps. I think this probably hurts his chances. But if it was the other way around and they won 3-0 or 3-1, I think it would have helped his chances. Winning in this fashion, though, I don't really – I mean, question to you, how much can you really pin on the coach? You set them up for success. They go out there. They also, though, you got to think about it's Coventry, right? So you're in a semifinal of the FA Cup against the Championship side. Coventry, the three sides that came up from the Championship last season are getting their ass beat in the Premier League. There's no difference for Coventry next year if they come up. They're going to be in the same positions that Burnley and Luton Town are going to be in, right? So it's to me, it's no special feat. I think embarrassment comes to mind a little bit, obviously, letting the 3-0 lead slip. I don't know how much you can pin on Erik ten Hag on that. But,
yeah, you know. I get that, but two things that you can, and I think you brought it up a few minutes ago, that's a good point. There is no identifiable structure or style of play Like, yes, Arteta, when he took over, he needed patience, but they also had a clear style of play. Like, maybe he didn't have the players for it, but he wanted to play out from the back. He wanted to press high up the pitch. You know, he wanted to be compact out of possession. All that was evident, even though he didn't have the horses at that time. Now he does, and now they're at the top.
Yep.
What's Manchester United going to look like next year with another $250 million spent and Ten Hag at the helm? I just personally, again, I'm sure you're the same way. It was like towards the end of the time at Solskjaer. It's like, yeah, keep him in the job. That's great. I'm happy with that. Same thing. I would hate to be competing with United this summer for an actually good manager, a top class manager, because I'm not worried about Erik ten Hag winning a Premier League title at Manchester United. I'm not.
No.
I don't see it. And I think, yeah, obviously he's not totally at fault for, you know, them going losing that 3-0 lead. But at the same time, you know, the manager instills a mentality to keep the foot on the gas and that type of thing. And even to your point about Coventry, they're eighth place in the championship. It's not like this is a team that's cruising through. It's not the dominant team in the championship. They're mid-table. They're just outside of the playoff picture. So it's not some dominant force with this incredible budget. To me, it's definitely a little bit embarrassing. I think they're happy to get to the final, but I wouldn't say that it inspires confidence by any means.
No, and I think everyone during this game was they're Coventry versus Manchester United. They're killing each other in the second half just to go into the Wembley final and get smacked by Man City. So, right. If Manchester United win the FA Cup, then we can revisit this conversation somehow, because then that would be the epitome of the Manchester United season, where they play super poorly one week, then they pull out a win against Liverpool another week. They don't make any sense. They're very similar to how Chelsea were in the beginning of the season. They would lose three in a row, then win one out of nowhere, or tie the big six in every competition that they played. It makes no sense. And it's all about having that uniform look and kind of playing style. So to me, that I'm with you. They don't have it. But, you know, this was a shortened weekend. We had four teams, or we only had seven games total. So we had six teams that were out due to the FA Cup semifinals that we had. So this week, we're actually going to have a double week. Well, technically, I guess this is our double week. But we did have some rapid kicks honors to go through. And we'll start off with Arsenal, just because I'm talking right now. They won 2-0 over the Wolves at the Molineux. This is now a record amount of away clean sheets in a row for Arsenal. So it's nice to get another clean sheet back in there. They lead the Golden Glove and most clean sheets race for the rest of the season. We did have a nice Leandro Trossard goal and Martin Odegaard goal that put the game away in stoppage time in the 92nd or 5th minute. So back on top for now of the Premier League, but only due to the fact that Man City was not able to play this weekend.
Yep, and then moving over to the other team in the title race, Trent Alexander-Arnold scored an absolutely beautiful free kick in this one.
Gorgeous.
His first start in the Premier League in over 2 months, and then Ryan Gravenberch also scored his first Premier League goal as Liverpool defeated Fulham for the third time this season. They also faced off in the Carabao Cup semifinals, and Liverpool keeps pace.
The final title contender, Man City, beat Chelsea in the other Wembley semifinal for the FA Cup. They advanced to the final again, thanks to Bernardo Silva with his winner. Kind of a small bit of redemption from what I snagged at him the other day with the penalty kick miss. So this will be their first back-to-back. They will look to be the first back-to-back FA Cup champions since Arsenal 2013-14 and 2014-15. Continuing going on a bit of a smackdown now that I mentioned before is Brentford 5, Luton Town 1. Other than really harming Luton Town's ability to kind of get out of the relegation zone on this was probably the first real bright side for Brentford. This is their first time all season that they scored more than three goals in one game. And this was also done without Ivan Toney, who wasn't even on the bench due to a hip issue. So very impressive outing from Brentford, who Wissa scored his 9th and 10th goal of the Premier League season in this game.
Yeah, I don't know where they would be without him. He's been crucial for them this year, particularly obviously Toney out with the betting allegations.
Yep.
And then Mbeumo, got hurt, missed most of this calendar year. Wissa's been huge for them, especially from open play. I think nobody has more than 5 goals from open play this year. He's got 10.
He's got a contention for goal of the year too, right? With a bike,
yeah.
I think against Chelsea. But yep, really, exactly. Really impressive. And in the beginning of the season, we said with the Ivan Toney thing, great point you just mentioned. We all thought Mbeumo was going to be the guy for the Bees. So huge, huge shout out to Wissa.
Yeah, he's been great. And then talking about another guy who scored an overhead kick this weekend, it's my now new arch nemesis, Eberechi Eze, scoring a beautiful goal against West Ham in a 5-2 thumping at Selhurst Park. Just dominance from Eze and Elise. When they're on the pitch, they are so fun to watch. Just a matter of them both being fit, and we're seeing, you know, the fruits of that right now. They just look to be they're a pleasure to watch. Like I said, they're just so smooth on the ball. They both had a goal and an assist in this game. Mateta had a double, and West Ham, I mean, honestly, this game, the scoreline flatters West Ham because it could have been worse. It was 4-0 within 30 minutes in this one. And it really, like I said, could have been a lot worse. And then moving down, or I guess up the table, we have Aston Villa 3-1 over Bournemouth at Villa Park. Ollie Watkins takes the reins in the playmaker of the year race with his 11th and 12th assists. And it was a wingers get a goal day. It was like Oprah, you know, you get a goal, you get a goal, you get a goal. Diaby, Bailey, and Morgan Rodgers all scored off the wing in this one. Morgan Rodgers, another guy, he was signed in January, and he's been pretty impressive to me. You know, in the brief cameos I've seen of him at Villa since he moved over, ex Man City boy. But I've just been impressed with him. I thought he deserved a shout out.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to re-highlight Ollie Watkins, he now leads the league in goals plus assists with 31, followed by Cole Palmer, who just recently put back-to-back hat-tricks into his pot there, and then Mohamed Salah at 26. You still have the top scorer as Erling Haaland tied with Cole Palmer, and Watkins is just one below him for the Golden Boot. Well, I think we can kind of cruise right into the segment, little three here. But why don't we take 2 seconds, get a little fun music in there, recollect our feelings, thoughts, and we'll be right back to do the weekend look ahead. Okay, well, we have a lot of midweek fixtures this week since we had, I think it goes all the way back to week 29 when the FA Cup games, as well as I think some other international duty games were kind of mixed in there. I think it was primarily FA Cup. But we have Brighton versus Man City at the Amex as our first highlight here. So you have one draw, one loss, and one win in the last 3 visits to the Amex. So we're hoping that this one could possibly be another opportunity for some drop points to spin the tile race around again. Although, based off of the recent forms and the current injuries to Brighton's Ferguson, Milner, Billy Gilmore, returning from injury is Ferguson, Milner, and Billy Gilmore, maybe we can see something. Still, I think the man that matters the most in Matoma, who is out for the remainder of the season, is a massive loss. And you can see it with the recent team form. Brighton have only scored 3 goals within their last 5 matches in all competitions. Not really a good look if you're going up against Man City, who have scored over, let's see here, 1, 6, 11, 14, 18 goals over their last 5 games. And only, I mean, I think that's it. I think Man City wins this one. This would be one of 3 remaining games for Man City that I could see possibly dropping points, the other 2 being away at Fulham and away at Spurs. I think the Spurs being the more likely of the 2, but maybe we can get something fun from this game.
Yeah, hopefully. Moving down to a game that should definitely be fun is Aston Villa versus Chelsea. European implications on the line for both teams. First time they met up was a 1-0 victory at Stamford Bridge, with Ollie Watkins, shocker, scoring the winner in that game. But, you know, obviously Villa's looking to take advantage and stretch their lead in 4th place over Tottenham. Obviously, Tottenham's got a really tough game that we're about to get into. Meanwhile, for Chelsea, a win in this game or a win tomorrow against Arsenal would put them in a European place for the first time in the entire season, and probably dating back to last season for a large stretch of it. I can't even remember the last time that Chelsea was in a European place, which is crazy to say because they're usually a staple for that type of thing. But they've certainly been hot of late. No defeats in their last seven, obviously just Premier League. I'm not counting the loss they just had to City at the weekend, but will definitely be interesting. One thing to note is that Cole Palmer is sick. So I think he's supposed to miss the Arsenal game tomorrow, but he could potentially also miss this Villa game on Saturday as well. So something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I guess he had too much ice in his veins and has caught a bit of a cold.
He's
I guess
Palmer.
That's what happened, but he's Cole Palmer. But absolutely, I think that's an important one to note. It's crazy, like you said, that Chelsea are finally getting themselves into pole position. I just don't want them to get European soccer because I'm so curious to what that would mean financially for these guys. Even if they get into the lowest form, being the Europa Conference League, I still want to see what kind of – it's better than nothing, but the ramifications for them for their multi-billion dollar spending spree that they've had over the past two seasons – I can't see them keeping a lot of people. Speaking of keeping a lot of people, I did see today that Thiago Silva will be leaving Chelsea at the end of the season. I believe, is he 41 or 39? I can never remember. I think he's got to be in his 40s at this point. But
dude, I'm pretty sure he was alive for both World Wars. Like, hey, Thiago, what was World War One like?
I mean, it's brutal. He is a living legend. He is 39 years old. He was born in 1984, and his preferred foot is right, but that's just because it's right next to his age that I read that. So it's just he's a living legend. I still think he's one of the best. He was actually in my team of the season last year, if you remember our team of the season episode. I think he was miscredited with a lot of Chelsea's woes, and I think he was the only bright spot in Chelsea last season. So I'm sure he will be missed, and I'm sure that he will have a send-off during their last home game at Stamford Bridge. As far as another London stadium goes, we have a North London derby at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium this Sunday. This comes after you mentioned the Chelsea-Arsenal game, which I think has massive implications on momentum for Arsenal. If they were to win that game going into the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium game, this looks like a game that Arsenal has to win in order to keep pace with the title race, mainly because Spurs still have to face Liverpool and Man City. So Spurs will be a massive deciding factor in this. And they also, Spurs that is, are trying to keep their hope to try to close the gap on Aston Villa, who's currently in fourth place, only 6 points ahead of them. But Spurs do have two games in hand. So if they win those games out, they'll be able to push through, I believe, on goal differential. They might actually be leading them. Other than that, this is kind of coming at a rough time for Arsenal. A great time for Spurs, maybe not a great time for Spurs, though. And it's because it's the opposite side of two coins. Arsenal will have played, including the game tomorrow, will have played four times within essentially the same period that Spurs have not played a game, 15 days. Like I said in the last podcast, like Spurs would be rested for 15 games, and their first game is coming up on Sunday against us. So there's a good side to that and a bad side to that. A good side is meaning you get to rest the people who might be right on the fence, maybe mend some of those injuries, maybe one or two of the knocks. But the downside of that is if you're a professional football player and you're in the heat of everything, you want to be consistently playing, not overplaying, but you want to be consistently playing to keep sharp, keep your touches moving, and the whole nine yards there. So it will be interesting to see which team is affected more, either due to lack of playing or the excess amount of playing. I think Arsenal has been in a bit of a knocking woe troubles. Saka's been playing with a bit of an injury or knock relatively for a large portion of the season. Not a lot of rotational players going out over there on the right side of things. And you can kind of start to see the legs kind of getting weary on the Gunners, like we did see in the last season. So I think a big question to Mikel Arteta next season is, can we get a little bit more rotation going? And I think that's a large portion of a lot of people's comments and concerns with this Gunner squad. Being out of the Champions League competition obviously sucks. The fact that Liverpool and Man City are also out of their respective European tournaments also sucks in the terms of Arsenal, because that means everyone's focus on the top three will be on the Premier League title race. If City were able to advance through, maybe we would get a little bit of a eased pressure there, but it's full guns ablaze it for everybody. So a little bit of head-to-head, right? So earlier in the season, the Spurs did come back to tie the match 2-2. That was over at Emirates Stadium. And last year, Arsenal did do the double over Spurs for the first time in a few seasons. So over the last five competition or last five matchups, Arsenal have won three of the five, with one draw and one loss in there. So it'll be very interesting to see where this game kind of goes. You have a great point here on a big blow for Tottenham. So why don't you kind of pick it up from there?
Yeah, absolutely. A huge blow. Left back Destiny Udogi is out for the remainder of the season after he got left quadriceps surgery this past weekend. And like you said, it's the classic case of rust versus rest. Is it better for Tottenham to be, you know, resting? They never really went on a run in any of the FA Cup or Carabao Cup. They didn't have European competition, so this may end up playing against them. But that'll be something to monitor. And then obviously, like, you know, like you talked about with Udogi being out, it's either Emerson Royale or Ben Davies up against Saka. It's going to be difficult for them to manage that. And we know Ange is going to play his style no matter what. Ange ball will be in full effect. So that's going to mean that there's isolated instances where Saka can cut in and create chances, whether that's for himself or for others. Definitely going to be, for me, the pick of this week, you know, despite the fact that we have, you know, double match weeks. I think this is clearly the biggest game of the weekend. So definitely one that I'll be tuning into on Sunday.
Yeah, absolutely. And another possible big blow for Spurs is Pedro Porro. It did leave the Newcastle 4-0 thrashing on an injury as well. So both outside backs for Ange Postecoglou could be out. And Pedro Porro has been one of the right backs of the season for me, right there with Diego Dalo and Ben White has both been relatively impressive for me. Is Diego a left back or is he a right back?
He's played both this year. Yeah, typically a right back by trade. I think he's right-footed, but given the injuries to Malacia and Luke Shaw, he's had to play quite a bit of left back as well. Yeah.
So I'm with you. This is going to be a huge, huge game for the Gunners on Sunday at 9 o'clock in the morning. You'll find me hopefully at a beach bar watching that one in Miami. So we'll see how we do there. Well, without further ado, I think Kyle has been the lock of the week king for the season. And I use king very loosely, maybe like Courtchester, maybe the best one out of all of us. But unfortunately, he wasn't able to join us, but he did get his lock in. And that is Wolves over Luton Town at the Molyneux. This is plus 100 on Saturday. So I think this is great odds. But the last time we all agreed on something like this, I'm pretty sure there was an earthquake, then a solar eclipse, and then the apocalypse started. And of course, the only thing that was guaranteed to happen was the lock missing. So I think... I think this one should be a win for the Wolves as well. They did play relatively good against Arsenal. They just weren't able to really develop anything against the defensive brick wall. But they, you know, the Wolves have been a very feisty team this season. And if they want to continue to compete, at least in the upcoming, middle of the table, they're going to want to really put their best foot forward on this one.
Yeah, no, listen, I think it's definitely a good pick. The one thing I would, you know, caution is they have a lot of injuries, and I think that's part of the reason why they didn't put up as much of a fight against Arsenal. I mean, like, they could compete, but they just didn't have that individual quality. There was no Matthias Cunha. I think he's out for a little bit from a muscle injury. Obviously, we know that they're also without Neto for quite a bit of time. I don't know if he'll be back for the end of the season or not. So that individual quality is definitely lacking. But I still think, across the board, they're a better team than Luton. But who knows? Luton's desperate. So could be a huge result for them. Definitely one that, again, is one of the best games to watch this weekend.
Yeah. Desperation always leads to some excitement. So definitely keep an eye out on this one for the weekend. Outside of that, we have midweek fixtures like we spoke about before. So it's going to be jam-packed. And I'm sure next Monday we will have nothing but excitement to dive into even further. Until then, though, that's it for this weekend's episode. Sean, thanks for joining us. Thanks for being here as always. And thank you all for listening and continuing your support and your comments. Until next time, enjoy the remainder of your week and weekend. This is the EPL State of Mind, signing off.